Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Buddhaṃ dhammaṃ saṅghaṃ namassāmi.
Well, it's been a great delight to be visiting Vyagiri Monastery this last 10 days or so. One of the most pleasant or inspiring things about this is to see the continuing well-being and flourishing of the monastery, and that it's a great sense of say, mudita for everybody who lives here, the monastic community, the lay residents, those who are living nearby, those who are the of friends and supporters of the monastery. Coming from far and wide, it's really quite wonderful to see this continual development and flourishing. I really had absolutely no doubt whatsoever that it would continue to develop and to blossom in this way after I departed a couple of years ago. But even though I had no doubt that this would be the case, just being in the midst of this kind of flourishing and all of the many, many signs of well-being and good health that the monastery is enjoying in many different dimensions. It's very conscious and apparent. See, enjoyment rises up within me, seeing how everything is continuing to take shape in a very beautiful and wholesome and appropriate way. And when we consider the, say, development of a monastery or how things are progressing, often our attention can go on to the numbers of monastics who live in a place or the number of buildings, the state of say, of repair of the buildings, the extent of the amenities, and the number of events that a place hosts or supports during the course of a year. And these are sort of external features of monastic development, and that these are, say, one way that we can look at things. But it's more important, I feel, or one of the things that comes to mind that I would say is more important, is to consider, rather than the many and various external signs of development, in a way to look back at the root and to ask ourselves, what is a monastery for in the first place? What are we all doing here? The gathering together, here we are on a Saturday evening, the shrine completely buried in orchids and roses and beautiful objects of devotion and expressions of, say, commitment, devotion towards the Buddha, the Dhamma, the Sangha, the routines of the monastery, the different projects, the building projects, the retreats that are organized, the different programs for the lay community, the Upasika program, and so on. The community who are here, those who have gone forth, the people who have come to live here as monastics, trying out monastic life, living here as lay people. Yeah, what are we all here for? Whether it's a short visit or a long visit. Yeah, what is a monastery? What is it for? Because oftentimes we can consider that we get so drawn in by our particular responsibilities, looking after the kitchen or balancing the account books, working out the trenching between kutis, trying to lay new lines for electricity and gas and water, and we can be taken into the view that, well, this is what a monastery is really for. It's about building kutis, or it's about preparing and offering food. It's about printing Dhamma books. It's about running events. But I feel it's a helpful and important thing to consider. What am I here for? Even just coming to listen to a Dhamma talk. Why come to listen to a Dhamma talk? What is this for? Why do we do this? Why do we shave our heads and put on robes and take the precepts and say study the teachings and try to develop the practices of meditation? And I'd say from my own point of view, and looking at this, considering this kind of question over many years, the main aim, the principal purpose for all of us, whether we're a layperson or a monastic, here long-term, short-term, just for the evening, or we've been here for 30 years or more, is to, awaken to the potential that we have as human beings, the point of all of these elements, the elements of devotion, the elements of self-discipline, of the many and various teachings and practices. Now, all of it is geared towards the one point of helping our heart to awaken to the true nature of things, to awaken to its own nature and to the nature of all things, to realize the truth, to realize the Dhamma, as it is called. This is what it's all for. This is the purpose of all of the practice, all of the work, the traditions, the forms, the many and various structures and routines, practices that we employ. All of it is really geared for the one purpose of helping the heart, the mind, to realize the Dhamma, to awaken to that truth, and to through that awakening, through that realization, to arrive at a quality of true peacefulness, true ease and contentment in life. Now, this quality of peace or contentment is something that attracts us all. It's something that the heart longs for. It's a natural, gravitation, and the heart is drawn by the possibility of peace, of ease, of true rest, if you like. But oftentimes we get distracted into that, thinking that quality of ease or peace or rest, it comes when it's the weekend, or it's the observance day, or it's the work period is over, or I'm back at my kuti by myself, or it's when I can retire from my job, or when the debts are paid off, or when the reception hall is built, when the next project is completed, when we have a break, when we get off on retreat, or we go on a holiday, or when the kind of present task is over. So this is what in Britain they call the thank God it's Friday principle. Longing for the weekend, longing for the break, longing for retirement. And these are natural enough, straightforward and ordinary and natural attractions that we experience. But as we all know, just because it's the weekend, just because the work period is over, or just because we have a holiday, or just because the weekend comes, that doesn't bring any real and substantial and lasting satisfaction. But the pull is there. And if we don't see that the mind is say, being drawn by the promise of that, that quality of peace or rest, if we don't recognize that it's that fundamental quality of peace or ease is being substituted by a sort of replica or a token of true peace, then we keep chasing the next one. We keep looking forward to the next retreat, the next holiday, the next break, so that we can relax, or we can feel good. But I feel it's important to understand, and this is a principle I reflect upon a lot, that work or activity or engagement is not an obstruction to peacefulness. It's a true peace, the peace of Nibbana, the peace of true ease and contentment, doesn't come when it's the weekend. It doesn't come when it's the observance day, or when the work period's over, or when you are retired. Yeah. That's not, the primary or the significant cause for peace, but rather peace, true peace and true ease come from what we can call right attitude or right view, right understanding. And when we look at things in this way, then we are, say, not regarding work or activity or engagement as some kind of intrusion on our time or on our life. It's not an intrusion upon our space, but rather that we're looking for peace or ease in the way that we handle it. Then it really changes the landscape of our life, the way that we operate. When we are able to say change our view in this way, we can see that we can be engaged. We can be, say, in the company of others. We can be in the midst of activity. And we can begin to see that true peace, true ease, true contentment is something that's based upon the openness of heart to the present moment. That we're not looking for things to be different, not looking for things to be over, or not waiting for a particular set of perceptions before we can be happy. But rather, it's a commitment of the attention to the present moment, regardless of what the content might be, whether things are actually quite noisy or busy or require a lot of initiative on our part, a lot of responsibility, a lot of close attention, or a lot of physical exertion. That when we shift the attitude to be open and accepting, attentive to the present, then we find that we can work with a peaceful heart. We can apply great physical effort with a peaceful heart. We can apply ourselves. We can be with others. We can engage in a conversation, not waiting for it to be over. We can engage in a particular project or program or an effort, and we're not looking forward to when it's all done or complete. We're not, say, putting off the possibility of peace or fulfillment. We're not putting off that. That enjoyment of our life to some future time, to some future point. point where there is a some kind of worldly completion, but rather it's, I say, recognizing that here and now, in this very moment, there's nothing missing, there's nothing intruding. The Dhamma is right here. The true and full reality of our own nature and the nature of all things is right here. There's nothing in the way. There's nothing that's intrinsically interrupting that or impinging upon that. There's nothing stopping us from being completely peaceful and at ease, even in the midst of activity. Now, I realize that my view might be considered biased because I have a character that's comfortable in the midst of activity, and I'm not particularly prone towards trying to run away from engagement or human company. But even if that was not the case, even though I was more drawn towards solitude or physical disengagement, I would still say that this principle holds true, and that because we can see for ourselves, as long as the mind is sort of waiting for things to be over, has a begrudging attitude towards the work that we do, or is buying into that, oh, wouldn't it be marvelous when I can retire? Oh, I'm looking forward to the weekend. Oh, it'll be great when I don't have to bother with this, or this is such a chore. I wish I didn't have to do this. If we look right at that attitude, whatever it is that is being promised off in the future, and whatever it is that we are being, faced with, we're experiencing, we can see right there we're creating a tension in the heart. We're creating dukkha, suffering. We're creating dis-ease, discontent, right here. Because what we're saying is, the way things are in this moment they're unwanted, they're wrong, they are an intrusion, they're a burden. And somewhere else, over there, then things are better, things are good. The promised land is over there, the golden age is over there, the happiness of retirement is over there. But just like the ever receding horizon, the more that we go towards it, we keep heading towards the horizon, the horizon keeps receding from us. And so that when we are setting our minds up in this way, kind of looking forward to some sort of the promise of peace or ease in these worldly fashions, when we look, we realize we never quite get it. There's always something that's still a burden, something that's still an intrusion, something that's still getting in the way, something that still bothers us. So I feel this is a really important way to understand that the nature of work and the nature of engagement. And as I often say in Dhamma talks, this is a lot to do with freeing the heart from the habits of becoming, what in Pali is called bhava tanha, the desire to become. As whether it's with physical work or whether it's the work of meditation, desiring, working in our heart and our meditation to become concentrated, to get insight, to become liberated, or whether it's on the external level, working to build this particular kuti, this hut, or build this reception hall, or to finish the monastery, as long as it's me trying to get somewhere, me trying to get something, me trying to get over this, to get to that, as long as there's that dynamic is created, then right in that very framework, we are creating discontent. We are causing dissatisfaction. We're causing discontent right there. And so that when we feel that discontent, we feel that tension. This is so exhausting. I'm always, one thing after another, and always sort of, we blame activity. We blame the work. We blame the meditation. It's such a chore, all this meditating, all this me working on my mind. This is such a headache, such an effort, such a chore. There's such a kind of efforting, as we say, that we blame the meditation, we blame the building, we blame the schedule, we blame the work routine. And so we try to just switch off and not feel it. We try to sort of stop working or to stop meditation, to stop the things that we feel are the intruders, so that we lurch from, on the one hand, bhava tanha, the desire to become, to its polar opposite, the desire to get rid of, vibhava tanha, the desire to not feel, to kind of switch off, to not do, to not be. But as the Buddha pointed out, these are both causes of dissatisfaction, whether it's the desire to become and to get and to exist, to be, or the desire to not be, to switch off and not feel, to get rid of. These both cause very directly more and more discontent and dissatisfaction, because we can't really switch off, we can't really disengage, we can't really not be. And that very effort to disengage, it still doesn't free the heart, it still doesn't bring us to true ease, even though we might have stopped the meditation, stopped the work program, stopped everything we can to just sort of nullify ourselves. What we find is that there we are, alone in our armchair, seriously depressed. So to me, the key is right view, right understanding, and learning how to operate in the world through what is called the middle way. And this is a very simple principle, but also an extremely profound one that the Buddha described right in his very first Dhamma talk, the turning of the wheel of Dhamma. Right at the very earliest part of that talk, he describes the middle way, the way between the extremes of sensual indulgence and self-mortification. Also, you can see this is the extremes of the desire to become, the desire to get rid of. Me trying to get somewhere, me trying to be something, or me trying to switch off, and me trying to be nothing and feel nothing and just zone out. These are both the extremes. So the middle way is, in essence, learning how to apply right effort. And in the scriptures, the scriptural analysis of right effort, it is divided up into four parts. So right effort is defined as restraining the unwholesome from arising. So trying to work with the mind to restrain unwholesome thoughts and feelings and attitudes from coming into being. So making the effort to not give rise to aversion, to jealousy, to greed, to negativity, to fear. Or if unwholesome states, unwholesome feelings and attitudes have arisen, to consciously let them go. So if there is aversion, or if there's greed, if there's jealousy or such like that has already arisen, to consciously let them go, to release them, to relinquish them. Then the third part of right effort is to cultivate the wholesome, to consciously bring loving kindness, compassion into being, arouse the qualities of a sympathetic joy, joy at the good fortune of others, to arouse the quality of equanimity, upekkha, to arouse wisdom, to arouse the qualities of samadhi, focus of attention, and to arouse faith, energy. These many, many wholesome qualities that the Buddha enumerated in various different places. So the cultivation of the wholesome, bhavana. And then the last part of right effort is anurakana, to protect and to cherish, to sustain whatever wholesome qualities have arisen. So if loving kindness has arisen, then to sustain that, to maintain that in being. If there is wisdom, if there is faith, if there is energy, to rouse, having roused that, and then to keep it alive, to maintain it. And when we look at the many and various lists of wholesome qualities that you find in the scriptures, the seven factors of enlightenment, the 10 paramitas, the five spiritual faculties, the eightfold path, I mean, all of these have the qualities of energy or effort, virya or samavayamo. These all contain this quality of energy, of effort. It's a path of doing. It's a path of action. It's a spiritual path that requires a sort of determined engagement. And so, even though it involves a lot of doing, that doing is directed towards peacefulness. So it can be mysterious. It can be confusing, because we associate peace with disengagement, with not doing, with the long holiday, with the infinite retirement. So peace equals, you know, a kind of grand armchair experience, or the sort of a very long day at the beach. Yeah. Peace, peace at last. Yeah, this is the sort of worldly images of peace, or life on the Lilo. Yeah. Floating on the pool in the under the shade of palm trees, or a really, really good lazy boy recliner. But when we consider things in this different way, begin to see that when we are practicing right effort, when there is a true development of samavayamo, right effort, that perfect effort, balanced effort, then all of that cultivation of the wholesome, letting go of the unwholesome and so forth, that is not being driven by a sense of self. The difference between the kind of doing that we're familiar with, me trying to get something, me trying to build something, me trying to develop something or be somebody, that is the suffering that it comes from the desire to become, the desire to get rid of, the dukkha, the dissatisfaction that comes from bhava tanha and vibhava tanha, that is driven by self-view, that's driven by the I and me and mine. That's what makes it alienating. That's what makes it exhausting. That's what makes it burdensome. Both trying to switch off or both trying to get switched on. It's the I, me, and mine element that is the cause of disharmony and discord within us. And when the heart is freed of self-view, freed of that conceit of identity, and efforts to concentrate the mind, efforts to arouse wisdom, efforts to be helpful to others, efforts to carry out construction projects or, you know, teaching engagements, or, you know, the work that we do in our livelihoods amongst the lay community, when that effort is not based upon self-view, when there's no I, me, mine driving that, when self-view is absent from that, then in a wonderful and mysterious way, there's a doing, there's engagement, there's an energetic involvement, but it's perfectly peaceful. There's no stress involved in it. There's no cause for alienation. There's no cause for that dissatisfaction in the heart, so that there's we begin to see in this that to do or to engage or to work is not an intrusion upon our ease, not an intrusion upon our freedom. It's not an intrusion upon our space or our being. Rather, even in the midst of activity, engagement, and as a decision making, taking initiative, taking responsibility, there can still be an absolutely spacious and joyful ease, even as the work is going on. As long as there is a freedom from self-view, as long as there's not a me who's driving things, or a me who's trying to get some particular experience, or me who's trying to get somewhere. As long as there's an abandonment of that, those habits of self-creating, what the Buddha called ahankara, made of I am, mamankara, made of mindness, and the heart is free of those I-making and mind-making, then it's a joyful and unburdened experience that we have, whether we are alone and with no thing to do, quote-unquote, or whether we're in the midst of lots of others and life is very noisy and active. There is still that joyful, unburdened, and easeful quality. I've been reflecting on this kind of thing a lot, mostly from moving to Amaravati and taking over the role of abbot there, is that I receive a lot of people's projections. Also, people coming back here and everybody asking me, oh, you know, it must be such a burdensome job, or having so many responsibilities, or being on 16 committees. You know, you know, I appreciate the sympathy, people's compassionate concern. But it's also interesting how often there's the assumption that, oh, I bet you'll be glad when it's all over, or I'm sure you're looking towards retirement, or, you know. But I find that as soon as the mind thinks in those terms, as soon as you're thinking, oh, well, when, you know, what about retirement? Right there, you create the cause of dukkha. Right there, there's a dissatisfaction, and that. It's so striking to me how immediate that can be, waiting for something to be over, looking forward to something ending. Then, right as soon as the mind takes hold of that and buys into it, right there is that tension. There's that alienation. There's that, oh, you know, what I've got here is not as good as what I could have over there. What I'm stuck with right now is not as pleasant as the prospect of what I might have over there, off in that different me, off in the future, yeah. And you know, right there is the cause that we've caused that sense of dukkha. So I find that it's much more helpful just not to think in those terms, and to very consciously not be waiting for it to be over, or not to be looking for an alternative, or not to be looking for an ending, but rather just to open to make the effort to open the heart to the present moment, and not to be thinking of what I'm doing as just this particular task of working on this plan, or leading this retreat, or giving this Dhamma talk, waiting for it to be over. But to open the heart, you know, fully and completely as possible to the present moment, and to not be limiting the idea of who we are, or what is of value, to the characteristics of this particular task. Because when we are saying, oh, I can be happy when I've changed my job, or I can be happy when this project is finished, I can be happy when I can focus my mind on the breath, I can be happy, you know, when I've retired, I can be happy. When I've finally become a novice, finally joined the monastery, finally got out of the monastery, when I finally got married, when I finally get out of this marriage, then, yeah, just even saying the words, you know, we can all recognize, like, oh yeah, right. We all know that territory, but yet we don't know the alternative. We don't recognize how in that moment we've, in a sense, confined the universe to that one particular attribute. And we said, oh, I can only be happy if I've changed my job. I can only be happy if I've moved to a different place. I can only be happy when I've no longer in white and I've gone into brown. when this work project is done, then I can have a retreat, then I'll be happy. And in buying into that, we've shut the door on the Dhamma that is available, apparent, real, here and now. We're sort of narrowing our view and buying into a dynamic whereby we say, I can't really be happy. I can't really enjoy life until this particular configuration has come about. So we're divorcing ourselves. We're sort of blocking off the quality of peace and joy and freedom that is available right here and now. Like we in the chanting, you know, every day, the Dhamma apparent here and now, timeless. Here and now, not like next week or when the reception hall is built or when the retreat comes or when the retirement from the work scene happens. It's here and now. And that's not just poetry. It's not just fanciful metaphysical thinking. It's the reality. And even though we repeat these words every day over and over again, we forget what they're pointing to. We forget that meaning. Another area where we in a sense fall into the same trap is in the way that we handle our own particular internal issues or particular areas of spiritual work, so that we maybe have a particular psychological trait, like our mind is very much drawn towards fear or towards lust or towards aversion. Our mind is very much drawn towards, say, insecurity, anxiety. And we might tell ourselves, oh, I've got a fear problem, or I've got a negativity problem, or I've got a dullness problem, I've got a depression problem, I've got an anxiety problem, I've got a restlessness, attention deficit disorder problem. And even though we can pile up all kinds of evidence and say, well, but I really have. I am averse to everybody. I'm always, my mind is always moving towards negativity. Or I am a worrier, I meet with, I find a way to worry about it. Yeah, I have got an anxiety problem. I have got a negativity problem. But I am depressive. The last 5 therapists I've had have all told me that. I've got diagnoses, certificates to prove it, medication. And so that we might have good reasons and all sorts of history to back up that self-view. But what we're doing in that is that we're confining our description of the world or who and what we are to that one little patch. We're saying, oh, I've got this problem, and I'm trying to be realistic about it. I've got to work with this problem. And we don't realize in the way that we pick up those particular traits or issues that we experience that we are creating a distorted picture of reality. But I have got a problem. I've got a physical problem. I've got a real illness, and I need to be cured of it. you can't just pretend it's not there. I have got this, this heart problem, or this muscle problem, or this diabetic problem. I am a diabetic. I have got a heart problem. I'm not denying that there might be these particular physical or mental issues at all. It's not that. But what we're doing is that we're narrowing our view to say, I am a diabetic, or I'm an aversive person. I've got a problem with dullness, or I've got a problem with anxiety. And even though on a matter-of-fact, common sense, everyday level, we might be able to say, well, yeah, I have. that's the problem that I've got. We don't see that in that moment we're creating a kind of solidified self-view. I am this person who genuinely owns this thing called a depression problem, or a muscle problem, or a heart problem, or a fear problem. And that this fear problem, or this aversion problem, or this issue, that has a constant, permanent, absolute existence. And I have got it. This is a thing that I've got. It exists, and I am its owner. We don't see that we're creating it in this way, and that and if with our sincere efforts to try and work on that, or deal with a physical issue, or medical problem, or a mental issue, that we are unconscious in the way that we are feeding self-view. We're compounding self-view. I am this real person who is the genuine and absolute owner of this thing. And my fear problem, or my aversion problem, or my lust problem, my medical problem, yeah, it exists. It has its own kind of little bubble of reality, and it's always there, and I've got to deal with it. And when I've dealt with it, when I've understood it, or I've got rid of it, then there'll be a me without that problem, and won't that be good? Me with this problem is uncomfortable and bad, and me without this problem is attractive and good. Sounds familiar? Yeah, so this is all very ordinary territory to us, but and this was an area of practice and understanding that I found Lumpo Sumedho's teachings extraordinarily helpful and very, very direct, because over and over again he would point to the fact that this is what the mind is doing. It's creating this paradigm of me and my problem. There's a me, and who's got, and I am the owner of this problem. It is real. I am real. It is mine. I am the owner. And me not having this problem, that would be a good thing, and I want it. Yeah, fair enough. You know, how many of us go to doctors and therapists and monasteries because of this precise dynamic? But what Lumpo would always point out is say that by the very way that we pick that up, the very way that we hold that, we create that paradigm of me and my problems, we're actually compounding, we're strengthening the causes of it, we're actually reifying it, we're making it that there's real, and we're strengthening the issues and creating more discontent, dissatisfaction, dis-ease within us, and that we can never ever really get through that, get beyond those issues. We can never really arrive at a place of clarity and peace through whatever amount of effort that we spend trying to get rid of that problem, or because the very way that it's being held is feeding it. It's like you're stoking the engine. And what he would always suggest is to shift the view to from me and my problem to here is the wisdom mind seeing the way things are. Here is the Buddha mind seeing the Dhamma. So rather than me and my problem, here's the quality of wisdom seeing the way things are. And for myself, I've worked with this mostly, or explored this mostly through the feelings of anxiety and fear that I might come across as a self-reliant, confident character. But for the longest time, the vast majority of my life, I was a fully paid-up worrywart, a true fretter, to such an extent that it was so normal for me to create anxiety and worry about things that I had no idea that this is what I did, and that, as I've often said, that my basic relationship to life was: if something exists, worry about it. Yeah, anything and everything, that the inside, outside, in my mind and my body, or the world around me, the basic relationship to all things was, If it exists, worry about it. And this is so endemic, so repeated. I had no idea that I was doing this. But after a number of years of monastic life and meditation, I began to see that my mind was always creating this sense of tension and worry and anxiety about how things were going to be or what way things were going to go, and in a way that seemed to be continuous and pervasive. It was always happening. It was always there. But then listening to Lumpur Sumedho talking about this, I began to see that then I, trying to work with it, that I had created this model of me and my anxiety problem, me and my fear problem. And I could see exactly what he was saying was so true, that, yeah, that's what I'm that's the way I'm holding it. That's the way that it's being framed. And what was most helpful was how he would say, you might tell yourself that it's always there or that you've got this problem, but actually it's not. And rather than it being you who have this permanent problem that you're trying to work on, actually what's more real and what is more true is that every so often there is the awareness of that feeling, say in this instance, of anxiety arising. It might arise very often, and you might think that it's always there, but when you look, it's just coming and going. There's a feeling of fear or other emotions or states, a feeling of desire, or a feeling of aversion, a feeling of jealousy. It arises, it does its thing, and it fades away. There's not a person who permanently owns that thing, but rather there's an awareness of that state, and that pattern of feeling arising, and it's present for a time, and then it fades away. There's the wisdom mind seeing the way things are, seeing that pattern of feeling arising and passing away. It's not a person, it doesn't belong to a person. There's no substantial thing absolutely there. And the effect of working with our particular issues, whether it's a mental state like this or even a medical issue, say, yeah, but I have got diabetes, or I have got a problem with my muscles or my bones or my legs or my heart, my lungs. It's still the fact that we don't experience that all of the time. the experience of those ailments, they are also things that come and go and change. They're not permanent, absolute realities. That the experience of them arises and passes away, and that just as with mental states like fear or aversion or desire. They take shape, they have a particular texture, they arise, they are known by the awareness of our own mind, and then they fade away. There's the Buddha seeing the Dhamma, the wisdom mind seeing the reality of the way things are. And the way things are is that things arise and pass away, and they're not self. So when we reframe our, say, particular issues or what we call our problems or these aspects of our body and mind in this way, it's remarkable, amazing how it transforms things. And for myself, I realized I had to work on this in a very directed way because it was such a deeply rooted habit. But it was a wonderful, miraculous to me how it really, after putting a lot of attention into this for a couple of years, 2 or 3 years, it radically shifted the way that those feelings were experienced, and also the sense of identity with being a worrier or being an anxious person or being afraid of things. And that when we shift the view, when we see things through the lens of right view and the actuality, because it's not just like we're pretending that then that they're not self, and that we're pretending that they're not really ours. It's not a pretense. In a way, we're stepping out of the pretense and learning to see the actuality. We're stepping out of the fabricated view and we're learning to see the real view. We're learning to see that there is an awareness of these particular patterns of feeling and sensation. They take shape, they arise, they pass away. It's the wisdom mind seeing the arising and passing of patterns of experience, of perceptions. That's all. It's not a person. They're not owned by anybody. They don't have any substantial reality. And it takes a lot of mindfulness and a lot of a commitment to reconfigure the way that we see, the way that we hold things. There's also a great need for patience. Over and over again, patiently and steadily coming back to the patterns of our experience in this way, and having the patience and commitment, steadiness to work with them. But if we do have that patience and that is applied in that way, then it really transforms the landscape of our life. It radically changes the way that life is held and felt and known. And that, and in a mysterious and strange way, it actually does solve our problems in many respects. I'm not going to say that every physical illness is going to be cured, or every character trait is going to be negative or problematic character trait is going to be completely wiped out. Not at all. But our relationship to them can change radically. And that the important thing is that we learn how to relate to those traits or those physical limitations and so forth with a balanced and unbiased and say harmonious attitude. We learn to work with the body and mind and to find a freedom within that, to find a great contentment and ease with the mind, the body, the personality and the world, but just however they happen to be. We learn to work in accord with life rather than finding ourselves over and over again battling against life, battling against the way things are, contending with how our body is, how our mind is, how the world is. We find ourselves able to live in a world of non-contention. So these are a few reflections I'd like to offer and to leave you all with. Early tomorrow morning, about 7:30, Lumpur Pasanno and his mother, Rhoda, and myself, and Debbie and Ajahn Khrunadamo aiming to be setting off down to the city, and then I should be hopping onto a plane, heading back across the pond, as it's called, to England. And I have no idea, no fixed plan when I might be back again, but I would like to, as I have been repeatedly while I've been here, I'd like to extend a warm welcome and invitation to everybody who would like to come and visit Amravati Monastery. It's a very large campus. It has accommodation for many, many people. We could easily take everybody here overnight. So that don't hesitate if you have the thought if you want to come across to come and visit as a regular guest, to come on a retreat, to help out with a winter retreat time, or just passing through for the day if you're in the country. But I'd be very, very glad to see everyone and to help build a kind of etheric bridge between Redwood Valley and Great Gadsden. Lumpur Pasanno and myself are kind of working on this, strengthening this connection. So please do make the effort if you can. But I won't hold it against you if you don't show up. So I offer these thoughts for consideration this evening. Sadhu.